This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, everybody. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson. Alongside this evening, Bloomberg's Opinions' Marcus Ashworth. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. It has been quite the week. We are not done yet. We have plenty to discuss. Let me just give you a kind of little soupçon of the news we've had over the last hour. Within the last few minutes, Giorgia Meloni has been named the new Italian Prime Minister. She has just named Giancarlo Giorgetti as her finance minister. He is a well-known member of the League, which is the very right-wing party for the north of Italy. Sets the tone, maybe, for her government. Mario Draghi is departing as Italian Prime Minister, the man that brought stability to that country. Here in the UK, we are watching political developments race ahead. We are now watching the potential for the return of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. We'll talk about that in just a moment. And within the last couple of hours as well, we've also seen a huge move in dollar-yen. Was it intervention? Is that what we've seen? Certainly, we've seen a move from kind of circa 152 down to the 147s. That is a huge trade. But was it intervention by the Japanese authorities? We'll discuss that as well. There is a lot going on, folks. Marcus, I was kind of hoping we'd be done by now, but we're not.
Well, no, I think next week is building up to be even worse. I mean, I think if we get the announcement of who's going to be Prime Minister by Monday, as is, I think...
UK Prime Minister we're talking about here,
UK Prime Minister, that's great. If we also get the rejection of the Italian Prime Minister's choice for Finance Minister, because the President, or the Italian President, has a right to overrule these things, then that could be interesting as well. So there's lots of different stuff, and clearly it was the Bank of Japan, possibly with the Fed.
Do you think it was the with the Fed? Okay.
Possibly, yeah.
Okay, we're going to need to talk more about all of this in just a moment. First, let's kind of set the stage. Let's get some headlines. Over to you, Charlie Powell.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Indeed, lots going on this Friday. Penny Mordaunt has become the first Conservative to declare she is running to succeed Liz Truss as Prime Minister as contenders embark on a frantic weekend of lobbying Tory lawmakers to get onto Monday's party ballot. Truss's dramatic resignation yesterday triggered a leadership contest that, coming so soon after the bitter one that put her into 10 Downing Street, is likely to deepen divisions in the party that look all but impossible to heal. The Financial Conduct Authority plans to fine Barclays £50 million for failing to disclose arrangements with Qatar during the bank's capital raising in the middle of the 2008 financial crisis. The FCA said Barclays did not fully disclose an agreement to pay advisory fees to Qatari investment vehicles as part of its efforts. The International Monetary Fund says it will advance work on a monitoring program with Ukraine as the government seeks to secure billions of pounds in aid after almost 8 months of war. And the heads of Britain's largest power and gas companies are calling on the government to rethink planned legislation that gives it the power to override the country's energy regulator. Companies including Centrica and EDF Energy have raised concerns that the energy prices bill, primarily designed to alleviate household bills this winter, expands the powers of the government to set the price cap on household energy bills, modify energy industry licenses, and, quote, give directions in market regulation. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. So as I've already indicated, much to discuss this evening. Let's start off with the UK. We're going to segue through the UK. We're going to go to a bit of Japan. And a little later on, about 18 minutes past, we'll go and talk about what is happening in Italy as well, because all of these stories could have a big impact Monday morning on markets. So, Marcus, let's start first of all. Mordaunt has declared. Is Boris Johnson going to declare?
The penny has dropped. Yes, of course Boris is going to declare, I'm pretty sure he is, unless it really is, he can't get anywhere near the 100. But you just have a look at the betting markets, and then in turn the gilt markets, because they're following what the betting markets are saying, and gilt yields are quite sharply higher, and that's because of the risk of Boris.
Do MPs care about the market reaction?
Oh, yes. They do.
Do they? Or are they more worried about trying to keep their jobs and they think Boris is the best option for that? They don't care about anything else.
No, I think they care about their jobs shorter term, at least, then you would say they would care more about having Rishi in, particularly because obviously, you know, he basically said exactly what was going to happen did happen. So in that context, you would say the sort of stability in the city type trade and financial markets calming down would be, you know, for aiming for Rishi. Penny Morden possibly has a bit of that glow because it's almost certain both of them would keep Jeremy Hunt. With Boris coming, we don't know. And obviously, there's, of course, a chance he does a deal with Rishi. I mean, it's highly unlikely, but who knows? They could make up. It's possible he could ask Hunt to stay on as Chancellor. It could be even more unlikely. It's possible that Hunt may say yes. So, you know, who knows? There's a lot of horse trading to go. But the fact that Penny Morden, I would say, was the third of the three running, has declared, shows this is going to be a proper three-way tussle into the weekend. As it comes to Monday, we should have a very clear idea of whether one of them isn't going to make it, and therefore it's a two-horse race, or they've all just realised it's only going to be one of them and the other drop out, and then we get an effective just a coronation, and therefore there's no need of the membership vote.
How does the market react? How do gilts react if it is Boris?
Well, I think they've told us that already.
But how much more? Just order. Yeah, we're up a little bit today, but global yields are up as well. So we're up a bit this afternoon. Gilts are up a bit more in terms of the yields.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say it's 15 basis points is more than, you know.
Yeah, okay. So Treasuries are up by 7, gilts are up by 15. So do we get much more than that is the question I'm really asking.
Yes, if there isn't a clarity on who is going to be Chancellor and what his exact financial plans are going to be. If it's going to be, without Rishi holding me back, I would have done what I would have done better, therefore I'm going to go for it again, then I think we have an issue. If it's, I've learned my lesson, I really want either Rishi or Jeremy Hunt to be Chancellor or someone of a very similar nature, and it's all about balance of the budget and let's try and get back to stability, then gilt yields will probably rise, but maybe not massively.
In terms of how you think the process will unfold, if it is a three-way race, so basically Monday, 2 p.m, if they've all got 100, which seems unlikely to me, do we then get, so we go from 3 to 2, we then get an indicative vote. What happens during that indicative vote if this whole process feels as factionalized as it does right now?
I don't think we get there. We get a three-way, you know, everyone gets 100 each. That is the nightmare, all right? Because what the 1920 committee is trying to avoid is that scenario. They want, at the very worst, a two-horse race. And really, they don't even want that two-horse race because, you know, whoever, say Penny Morden drops out and all her nominees go to Rishi Sunak and it's clear he's got a massive majority, the pressure would have heavily become on Boris to really, look, this is not going to happen. Please back away for a second. The Conservative Party, let's say he takes that on the nod and backs away, we get Rishi Sunak, which has always been my most likely scenario. But, you know, the force of Boris is just quite something, isn't it? So, you know, and that's clear what the betting markets are starting to move on, and clearly gilt markets are reflecting that.
Standards committees, all the kind of investigations into Boris, is that a problem?
Of course. Are there ways through that? Certainly it seemed like Liz Truss was going to move around that, and maybe she does one final favour as acting Prime Minister, but I don't think she's going to get a chance to. So, I think there are issues there, but I mean, to be quite frank, I'm not sure I would read too much into that, because I think they would have to have some substantive proof, which thus far hasn't come up, that he really was. Yeah. I personally think this we move around, but I don't know.
Do you think the grassroots get a say here?
The grassroots are going to
get a say.
No, it's designed so they don't.
I know.
If they do, it'll probably be Boris, and therefore, they don't want that. So I think it's very much the MPs have got a chance here to stop the self-harm, work it out amongst themselves who's going to be, and one person comes through with the coronation on Monday. That's what I expect, and it, I think we'll know that, you know, by Sunday.
Let me ask you the kind of the opposite of the Boris question. How do guilts react? Have guilts reacted already to the Sunak kind of Sunak hunt team? Is that... Do you think that's priced? Clearly, we've reversed some of that today, but do you think that was priced, or do you get another move lower in yields?
I think it's pretty much priced in. I think the markets are shocked that Truss has gone in that sense. But the fact that Hunt's staying and would stay under either the Sunak or Mordant scenarios, I think we priced about as much of that as possible. We may get a few basis points, but I know we're not going to go from 4% 10-year yields now down to 3.5 in gilts. I don't think, anyway. I think the premium for stability is small. The risk for a unexpected scenario is much larger.
What do you think the public makes of all of this? What do you think? How do you think the public would react to the return of Boris Johnson?
Well, the great thing about the British public, they have a fantastic sense of humour, and I'm sure you've received as many WhatsApps and various other different amazing scenarios of James Bond themes and all sorts of Lionel Richie songs and whatever. I mean, the creativity on Twitter and WhatsApp is quite extraordinary, TikTok. So in that sense, I think everyone's taking it with a sense of amusement, bemusement, and general derision. So, yeah, I think we are not... we're laughing at ourselves, but we are crying inside.
Okay. There's a headline crossing the Bloomberg now, so let's talk about it. We've seen a big move this afternoon in dollar-yen, 152 down to around 147. Nikkei is now reporting that that was the Japanese government, the Japanese authorities stepping in. Did they have any choice, do you think?
I've been amused reading people say, I don't think this is the Bank of Japan. It doesn't look like it did last time. Well, yeah, they had to do more this time. That's why. And they timed it perfectly. Two things which I find a couple of smart people have been mentioning. Don't intervene at 150. Let it get to 151. Yeah, yeah. Let it go right at the quietest point of the time and then go hard at it. And that's exactly what they've done. And when I said earlier that the Fed was involved, it may be that the Fed is acting on behalf of the Bank of Japan is what I meant to say there.
So in the time, okay, that seems more logical. Yeah, in the time zone, today would, yeah, okay.
So
does it really solve? Is this a sticky plaster or is this something more significant? Do you think? Because it feels to me like this is a sticking plaster. They are basically trying to sustain the yield curve policy. The market is pushing them hard. But ultimately, it feels like that's going to crack. And the pressure seems to be getting greater and greater at maybe a faster rate than maybe the Japanese authorities can tolerate.
They can tolerate a lot more pain than the market. And they have shown that through many decades. And their whole economic policy, I was about to say...
if they can tolerate pain, why are they in the market?
Well, because their whole is they can control two or three things, okay? They want inflation higher. They're getting inflation higher. They want to keep their bond yields controlled, or yield curve control, 0.25% for 10 years, no more. But they cannot control the currency at the same time. So the two out of three they can do, they can't do the third. That is the cost of doing living. So far, the Japanese industries are not complaining overly. Bear in mind, a weak yen has exactly the same problems it does with the euro and the pound, as it's importing very expensive energy costs. But nonetheless, on balance, the Japanese industry seems to be able to handle it to a level whereby it's not killing their stock market, for instance. So you look at the Nikkei, which is at 27,000, give or take. It's right in the middle of its range for the last few years, or a few months, 25,000 to 30,000 odd. Then it's not causing problems domestically. The only thing that's giving at the moment is the currency. As long as they can come in every now and again and catch people out on a Friday afternoon, then... I think they've got more power to it. So I personally think this is, the history of Japanese currency intervention has been hilarious. And this is not how they want to do it. Normally they like to go when the tide's coming back the other way.
I was about to say, normally you'd want to push against an opening door, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And then they've been forced to do, sort of keep the King Canute style here. But nonetheless, it's they're quite smart about it. They're doing it in the quiet times and having more effect that way.
It was interesting that the Swissie moved as well. Was that just a derivative? That's just a spillover, or was there something broader here?
I would say it's a derivative in the sense it's a spillover. I don't think there's anything particular. But these are very leveraged trades. I mean, a lot of people do what's known as the carry trade. and Burrow and Yen, what have you. And that's obviously what causes them sometimes a bit of a pain.
Going to take it to Rome next.
Unwinding of leverage trades.
Sure. And as you say, in a moment that maybe you get a bigger bang for your bang for your buck, quite literally. We're going to talk about what is happening in Italy in just a moment. We're going to take you to Rome. Giorgia Meloni is the new prime minister in Rome. We'll talk about the implications of that next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson alongside Marcus Ashworth this evening. This evening we have seen history made in Italy, in Rome. Giorgia Meloni is set to become Italy's first female prime minister. She is also going to be heading probably the most right-wing government we've seen in Rome since the Second World War. This has been confirmed within the last hour after days of negotiations with the president, Sergio Mattarella. Let's go to Rome now to get an assessment of the significance of all of this and kind of what comes next. We've also learned the name of the new finance minister within the last few minutes as well. Alessandro Migliaccio joins us from Rome. Alessandro, talk just to me about the significance of this moment.
Well, it's as you said, it's very significant. It's a strange moment, especially for women like me. I was talking to some colleagues outside the parliament. It's a woman. It's Italy's first female prime minister. She got the job all by herself, meaning she started in politics when she was 15. You know, she climbed up the ranks. She did the work, and she made it. And it was quite striking to see her today standing between all these older men, some of them known for not being exactly, you know, the most female-friendly types, and yet she made it all by herself, and she's prime minister. So that's, you know, that's something. And she's young, and she's, you know, not afraid of her femininity, and she has the blonde hair, and et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, as you said, this is Italy's most right-wing government since World War II. You know, she, when she was younger, she was part of a youth movement that was connected to fascism. I think now we speak more of ultra-conservative right. Call it what you may, but it's, you know, it's disturbing to some people. We don't know exactly what she will do next. But in any case, the list of ministers that we've seen was somewhat comforting. There were a lot of compromises. There were some interesting choices.
So, Alessandra, I mean, I'm trying to put this carefully because if you listen to what I've read of what Meloni actually says, compared to some of the media spin on what she is, where she came from, what various parts of organisations were a long while ago, is this really a right-wing government in the context it's still very much part of the EU? She's absolutely not making any movements. Why would she? Because the EU is going to give 200 billion euros to Italy over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. She's got to stick very closely to Draghi's, you know, plan and get the budget through at the end of this year. If she makes any missteps on that, clearly the bond markets will pay a very heavy price. At the same time, do we think that her appointments are going to get approved by Mattarella, the president?
Well, yes. So, I mean, you're right. She has no reason to misbehave, quote unquote. A lot of analysts are telling us, well, call it more an ultra-conservative government, particularly on social issues. I mean, issues like LGBTQ rights, on women, on abortion. The government is very conservative. On other things, she has said absolutely she will stand with Europe and with the United States on Ukraine. She has said that on the budget, she will be very careful. She has no intention of, you know, going crazy on spending. She will present a cautious budget. Her choice of finance minister is, it's a political appointment. He is a politician. He is part of the league. But it's also, on the other hand, someone who was in Draghi's government.
What do we know about him, Giancarlo Giorgetti? Just walk us through his history and kind of what he is likely to do.
So it's interesting because Giorgetti it comes from a very, very small town in northern Italy, not too far from Milan. It's a town of fewer than 800 people, where everybody has the same last name, according to his own description. And he then ended up going to Bocconi, which is a prestigious university in Milan. And then from there, he's had a long career as a politician. He's part of the Northern League, now called the League. But, you know, when he was in it, it was a separatist movement. We looked into it, and actually, when he was very young, he was part of the same youth movement that Meloni would then join 10 years later. She's much younger than him. He has a lot of experience. He's been in the budget committee for many years. He was development minister and did a good job as development ministers, meeting, for example, EU recovery plan targets. Some investors have told us, well, we would have preferred a more of a technocrat. He doesn't have exactly the pedigree that other finance ministers have had. We're used to having people who are really academics, who are economists, who, you know, are really deeply technocrats. He's not. He's a politician. But I think he's a good compromise. And even though he's in the League, which is kind of an extremist party, he's the moderate wing of that party.
So, I mean, okay, we've got a lot of extremists and right wings and ultra-conservatives going on here. But, you know, in essence, for markets, what we're concerned about is whether or not it plays by the EU Brussels rules. And it seems like he probably is going to. Therefore, that means that Mattarella won't bounce him for someone less or more technocrat. So if we've got such a strange thing as a democratic government, a non-technocratic government in Italy, which is the first for really quite a long while, I guess, since Berlusconi, how long is this going to last? I mean, bear in mind, I'm speaking from the UK here, so I have absolutely no right to question longevity. Nonetheless, it's very much on my mind how the UK government is going to last. And I would like to know what your best, you know, guess is. How long will this last?
That's an excellent question. I've noticed as a reporter that they generally last 2 years and then, you know, we have to go through this again. But that's just my personal view. It's really hard to tell. We'll have to see what Meloni, it's a coalition. We'll have to see what her allies do. Berlusconi's been misbehaving, let's put it that way, in the past few days. He's done everything he can to embarrass her. He tried to sabotage her choice for Senate Speaker, but he failed. He did not succeed. She said she would not be blackmailed, and she was not. So if she manages to control her allies and the other members of the coalition, this could last quite a while because, as you say, it is a political government. We've had left-wing governments as well, but we've had a lot of technocrats. And they have no reason, you know, the members of parliament to, you know, lose their jobs, let's put it that way. So it might last quite some time. But we'll have to sort of see how it plays out as far as whether the other parts of her coalition, whether they get, edgy, whether they start agitating, whether they begin asking for things like more borrowing, which Italy can't afford to do, as you know, in the UK, certain things you cannot put in your budget or you will be punished.
The UK got punished by the bond markets. We'll see how the ECB would react to that, how the BTP market would react to that, how Brussels would react to that. Alessandra, thank you very much indeed for your fantastic coverage. Alessandra Migliaccio. Up next, we're going to take you back to what is happening with the bond market more broadly and this yen move. That's next.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. 5:30 in the City of London. You're listening to The Cable. I'm Guy Johnson alongside Marcus Ashworth this evening. It has been a bumpy, bumpy week and we're not quite done yet. Let me try and get my words out. Let me just give you a quick brief resume of the price action. Then we'll get to Charlie and then we'll dig into some of this news we've had this afternoon. So the bond market move seems to have largely faded. You've now got, globally it's faded, you've got a 4.236 yield on a US 10-year. We do still have elevated yields in the UK. So the UK 10-year above 4%, we're up by around 12 basis points. Maybe some concern about the return of Boris Johnson being priced into that market. Equity markets in the States are now certainly regaining some traction as the yield story has faded. The S&P is up by 1%, 1.1%. The Nasdaq's up by 0.9%, despite some very disappointing news out overnight from Snap, which is basically based on the ad market. So that kind of could reflect on names like Alphabet, which is going to report numbers next week. The FTSE 100 finishing at 69.69, up by 0.4%. The real story over the last couple of hours has been the huge move we've seen in dollar yen. We've got up to around 152 dollar yen. We've now faded back down to 147. the Nikkei is reporting that the Japanese authorities stepped in to intervene in that market. So we'll talk about all of that in just a moment. Cameron Kreis is going to be joining us to kind of dig around all of the aspects of this stories, these stories that we care about. Let's get some headlines, first of all. Set the scene with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Penny Mordaunt stood in for Prime Minister Liz Truss temporarily in the House of Commons on Monday. Now she wants the job full time. She became the first Conservative to declare she is running to succeed Liz Truss as Prime Minister as contenders embark on a frantic weekend of lobbying Tory lawmakers to get onto Monday's party ballot. Truss's dramatic resignation yesterday triggered a leadership contest that comes soon after the bitter one that put her into 10 Downing Street in the first place. The Treasury may be forced to delay its long-awaited October 31st fiscal plan because of the resignation of Truss, adding a political risk to an event that had become crucial for markets and the Bank of England. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt is still working toward delivering the statement on October 31st, but sources say the final decision on scheduling the statement will be a matter for Truss's successor. A global anti-money laundering watchdog has removed Pakistan from its gray monitoring list after 4 years, providing relief for the South Asian nation that is facing a crisis. Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan says he is willing to meet Sweden's leader to discuss the Nordic country's bid to join NATO. Erdogan said he instructed his staff to respond positively to a request from Sweden's prime minister for talks. That is the latest from the news desk. Have a great weekend. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Greatly appreciated, Charlie. Thank you very much indeed. You too. Charlie Pellett on what is happening around the world. Let's dig into the stories that have been coming from the financial markets over the last few hours, and there are plenty of them. Earlier, we saw a huge move higher globally in yields. That has now faded. But the story over the last hour or so has been this big move that we've seen in dollar-yen. 146.90 is where we are now trading dollar-yen. Earlier on, we were up to around 152. A lot of people had a line in the sand at around 150. But the authorities clearly felt that that wasn't the moment to intervene. They let it run a little bit higher, as Marcus was suggesting, and then came in and hit these leverage positions pretty hard. You've had a big reaction to that. Let's kick it around a little bit. Let's talk about what this all means and plug this story into the wider picture. Bloomberg's Cameron Kreis joining the fray now as well. Cameron, dollar yen 146.88. Your thoughts on that move?
Yeah, pretty aggressive. I think the pattern you alluded to a second ago, letting speculators stop in above, stop into dollar longs above 150 and then slamming them down thereafter, is pretty accurate. The reports are they've been pretty aggressive, still offering even as we speak on the electronic broking system. In fact, one guy told me that they're offering below the market, but no one's got any more credit lines because they're all full. So that's a pretty clear statement of what they're trying to do. Will it work? Well, clearly it's worked in the short run. Can it fundamentally turn the tide in the yen? No, without a more generalized either reversal in Japan's current account flows, that's an improvement in the trade balance, or a larger degree of remittance of overseas income, or a more generalized decline in the dollar, which I don't think you can say the stage is set for that yet, barring a sort of a Fed capitulation, which clearly isn't forthcoming in the near term.
So it is really, we obviously see the pains caused in the United Kingdom, in Euro as well, with regards to the strong dollar. But really, of all the major economies around the world, the one suffering the most is clearly, I think, the yen. But it doesn't seem like the Bank of Japan is going to budge. But it's if we reckon it's about $20 billion they spent last time, I think this one looked like it was on a bigger scale. Have they got hundreds of billions to throw at this?
Well, technically they've got a trillion, right? in terms of their FX reserve balances. The irony, of course, is if they, in extremis, if they start selling hundreds of billions of dollars, then that's going to be pretty bearish for the treasury market, because they own a lot of treasuries. which would drive up Treasury JGB spreads, which would encourage more dollar buying, all else being equal. I mean, the solution to this problem is a lot easier than yep. selling a zillion dollars. That's get rid of the stupid yield curve control, which is, I mean, at this point, it's kind of dribbling insanity to try to keep yeah. a cap on bond yields in the midst of the greatest bear market in fixed income that any of us have seen in our lifetimes.
The expectation is that that doesn't happen until next year when we get a new boss at the BOJ.
Yeah, basically, Kuroda, for yeah. better or for worse, would see it as a loss of face to yeah. switch policy, which, I mean, come on.
Can he last that long? Can he last that long, do you think? Given as you say, that in some ways the intervention policy is in some ways at size self-defeating.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the short answer is I don't know. I mean, to my mind, I mean, this policy is so far past its sell-by date. It's you know, you remember, wasn't there a Marmite ad? I'm just reminded of this Marmite ad of someone having Marmite and hating it so much that they drank like 2 week out of date milk because it was you know, even that was better yeah. than the taste of Marmite. I mean, this is like Marmite squared if you don't like Marmite in terms of how bad a taste it leaves.
Yeah, but Cam, sometimes flares come back into fashion, man. You know, get with it.
Yeah, well. My name and fashion are rarely seen in the same room. Let's put it that way.
So what happens next? Do you think that they are just and do you think the frequency of these events is going to become greater?
Well, I mean, it seems to be a pattern that when we see an acceleration through a new big figure. And they feel like there's a speculative element to it,
yep.
that we're now at levels in the yen where it becomes an economic problem. I mean, the year-on-year change in Japanese imports in the last trade numbers, it declined very slightly from the prior month, but it's up almost 50, it's like 46% year-on-year, which is a level we haven't seen since the late 1970s. I mean, that's crazy, absolutely crazy, particularly given the context of waning global demand, China, no demand, basically. so clearly there's been massive issues caused by this. I think it's a lot of margin compression for domestic companies who have to import energy, because obviously Japan Inc. doesn't produce its own energy. And the weak yen just massively exacerbates that. And it's kind of we're at the point where it's a vicious circle. So they're at least trying to, if you will, excise the speculative element of that, which in fairness wasn't really that present for most of this run, because people were scared of this kind of pattern of behavior or a shift in monetary policy. But
Cam, can I just, I love that. I mean, can I have dribbling inanity or dribbling insanity? Doesn't really matter. But, you know, this widowmaker trade has lasted for a long while, as we all know, on JGBs. But if they let it go, I mean, there's no point lifting it from, 0.25 on 10 years to say 0.5, because it'll go there in a heartbeat, and then it'll go to 1%, and then it'll go to 2%. I mean, the point is that if the Japanese let the dams burst, they'll be out of control. They won't be able to control their entire bond market, really, as much as people would want them to. Yes, they do own or control close to 90-odd%, but even so, the markets have a way of moving very viciously. And I think that's something which I think they would have to be. I don't know how they get out of it because they've been in it so long. I hear you saying is it's, you know, with US Treasury yields pushing higher in the fours now, how can we have Japanese bonds still in the zeros? But you know, at some point, something will have to give. For the moment, I can't see how they can get out this hole without losing control of the whole shooting match.
Well, they've already completely broken the bond market. I mean, you go days without a single Japanese government bond trading. I mean, Think about it. That's crazy. Yeah. That's insane. You know, we're talking about one of the largest economies in the world, one of the largest bond markets in the world, and the stuff doesn't trade because...
We'd like that in the UK.
the BOJ, some would call it a feature rather than a bug, right? But, you know, A, it's a function of the fact that the BOJ owns so many, and B, that they're trading, that the level of bond yields is a completely off-market rate.
Right. Can we just change subject for just a moment? Because I want to get your take on this, Cam. Is a move from a hike of 75 basis points to a hike of 50 basis points from the Federal Reserve, as alluded to in the Wall Street Journal article this afternoon, a pivot?
That's stupid.
This is what they've
been projecting in the dot plot. So how can you say them fulfilling what they said they were going to do, you know, 4 weeks ago?
So if that's the case, why are they worried about a positive equity market reaction?
I don't know. I mean, listen, there are larger issues here. Why are they? It's difficult for us to talk about this objectively because we are employed by a rival. But it's Mickey Mouse. I'm sorry, it's Mickey Mouse to still, and the ECB does the same thing. It's totally Mickey Mouse to try to leak messaging to the market through your favored mouthpieces. I mean, whatever you think of the Bank of England, kudos to Ben Broadbent yesterday for basically saying the market is crazy. For pricing what they're, you know,
yep.
for pricing.
Yeah, 6 months too late though.
Well, maybe so, but at least the guy said it outright rather than trying to leak through their favored media media figure in kind of this is what we want you to think, but we can't say it officially type mode. Listen, I think they were probably a little ruffled by some of the price action in the bond market, which is becoming a little unruly. You look at the chart; it's virtually a straight line to the top right corner over the last couple of months, and the pace is pretty remarkable. I think would they prefer a little more two-way price action in the bond market? Probably. There's one thing. It's one thing to dampen demand in a way that's consistent with inflation coming lower. I mean, I don't think they necessarily want to cause a housing market crash.
No.
And I mean the for all the talk about mortgage rates in the UK,
The benchmark
mortgage yield in the U.S. is a 30-year mortgage, and that's up at like 7.25%.
The rate and the rate of change matter. Cameron, have a great weekend. Thanks, mate. Really appreciate it. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. Social media stocks have taken something of a battering today. A number of different causes for this. You've had numbers out from Snap, which were weak on the advertising side. That stock is down by circa 30%. Twitter's a more complicated story. Potentially, it looks like the US government may have issues with Elon Musk. We'll talk about that in a moment. We need to talk about Apple as well and what comes next week. Huge week next week for US tech. Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow joins us now in New York to give us an update on what we need to know here. Ed, let's start with Snap.
Sure.
Is this a macro story? Because this is a big advertising slowdown that we're seeing here.
Yeah, I think the biggest question from the street is how transitory this is for Snap relative to the other social media names that will report next week. You know, this is a stock that in November of last year was trading above $70 a share. It's now less than $8 a share, right? And I think this was a shock, right? You know, a shock to the market more broadly of how the ad environment continues to deteriorate. You and I discussed on TV about how actually they gave quite a lot of detail of what's happening. Budgets are being cut. There is concern about the impact of inflation on the consumer. there is concern that actually advertisers are preferring those platforms that are more established. You know, we forget that Snap is a relatively young company. If you're worried, you go and put your money somewhere else, like, you know, Google search, which has shown some more resilience in times of economic change. So, yeah, I think this was a shock to the system.
So, Ed, I mean, obviously we've got perhaps bigger ones coming next week, Alphabet and Meta. I mean, do we, obviously we don't read everything through because they're quite different beasts, but it, clearly this is, you know, we've had the sort of, I don't know, Walmarts and Targets have a wobble. Is this the turn for tech stocks?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in Meta's case, what's analogous with Snap is that one of the other headwinds was iOS ad tracking changes, right? And I feel like I've been talking about iOS ad tracking changes for quarter after quarter after quarter. It never really showed up in the bottom or top line. It is now. And you wonder if that hurts Meta further. And, you know, as for Alphabet and Google, they've shown some resilience, right? When the economy was changing coming out of the pandemic and the consumer was choosing travel and experience over things to do at home, frankly, they were one of the beneficiaries. What we're looking at broadly across all these companies because of their global footprint is a stronger dollar. And it's been really interesting to see the impact of a stronger dollar on both hardware companies, but also software companies that are particularly vulnerable in that point on their international revenues.
Does the US government have a problem with Elon Musk?
You know, I there's a lot of reporting here by Bloomberg News, but the top line is that, you know, DC and several government agencies are antagonized by what Elon Musk has said about the war in Ukraine, how he handled the use of Starlink in Ukraine and a short-term threat to kind of withdraw the service or the support for the service and the company.
This is the satellite communication service that,
exactly,
that the Ukrainian forces rely so much on.
Right, and so the complaint from SpaceX is that they're footing the bill for this to the tune of $20 million a month and that they can't keep doing it. They'll have to pull it unless the government comes in. And then the final part is, you know, Elon Musk buying Twitter, and I guess the concern there is that some of the equity partners he's lined up are from outside of the United States. According to sources, there's a consideration, therefore, if CFIUS needs to look at this. But it's well documented, you know, this idea of security review. Elon Musk has a security clearance level because he's the CEO of SpaceX, the most successful private commercial space company that does contracts for the Pentagon. But there's also this idea that if he owns Twitter, he'll own a platform that has really outsized societal influence relative to its user base. And also, simply, he doesn't get on with this administration, does he?
I mean, the thing I love about Elon Musk is he makes parts of the UK political system look quite normal. And long may he continue exciting us. But reference to the security aspect, you know, Biden has really clamped down, it looks like, on the chip-making aspects of business with China. I mean, I don't know if it's too much to conflate the security aspects of what we're talking about with Twitter here and the wider aspect of tech going, you know, into more than a cold war probably with China over this chip issues. Is there anything that we have to really genuinely worry about the tech sector?
Yeah, I think the way that I look at this as kind of a student of history and somebody that covers, you know, regulation on the tech side is it's big government versus small government, right? This is an administration that appears in different facets to want to have some oversight of what's happening. You know, they talk about tech export to China, particularly around artificial intelligence, as being an issue of national security. You know, it's really hard to draw parallels. You know, Biden and Musk don't appear as individuals to have a strong relationship. You know, Biden has made active choices to praise Ford and GM when it comes to the EV space and not Tesla, which is strange given it's the market incumbent. Musk has got some history. Remember, you know, he smoked marijuana on the Rogan podcast in 2019, which, you know, raised eyebrows at the Pentagon and at NASA. So I know that doesn't really answer your question. I would just say that, you know, I guess if you're an investor, you have to assess what the risk is here of government intervention companies.
Are they ready? Xifius maybe not be the right vehicle for this, but are they really ready to step in and maybe have some impact on the Twitter transaction?
Well, this is a good opportunity to say that the White House has responded to the Bloomberg report and said that they're not aware of any security review of Musk or Musk's companies. you know, this deal to buy Twitter was always going to get looked at by regulators, right? Musk got himself in trouble both with, well, review by the SEC and the FTC over how he disclosed his stake and communicated his attempts to buy the company. But there is a question about the world's richest man owning something, a social media platform of this style of influence. And also it's a sizable deal. These are very prelim looks at the security review level, right? Yep. Bloomberg sources tell us several agencies are wondering how they could do it, not definitely that they will.
Ed Ludlow joining us from New York.
That was a lot of stories. Whoa.
Well, no, we covered a lot of ground. This is why you're so good, Ed. This is why we appreciate you so much. Ed, safe travels back to San Francisco.
Thank you.
You're leaving New York this weekend. Really appreciated your time there, but really looking forward to seeing you back in San Fran. Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow. That wraps things up. Wow, what a week it was. I don't think next week is going to be any less bumpy. From Marcus and from myself, this is Bloomberg.